Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. On the show today, I'll be joined by the film critics Anna Smith and Jason Solomons, who'll be telling us which films we should be queuing up to see for the rest of the month and, of course, into the new year as well. And as many of you will be travelling home for Christmas, we'll find out about a new storytelling initiative in one Canadian airport. Plus, we'll have a rather festive global countdown too. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Anna and Jason, welcome to the show. Now, we are, of course, days away from Christmas. How will you both be celebrating, Anna?
I'm going out to the country for a few days with family.
That sounds
nice and
absolutely
chilled.
Divine.
It's going to be perfect.
Beautiful. Yeah. Jason,
I don't go away. No, I can't go away. I can't stay in people's spare rooms. They're too damp. They don't use them. They're cold. The windows rattle. There's always like a pile of boxes and a sort of exercise bike in the corner and something they don't use. And I'm not sleeping there, thank you very much. So I stay at home and cook and wash up for about 5 days solid.
Cooking and washing up at Jason's house. Unless, of course, you get an invite to a 5-star luxury hotel.
Yes, then I can probably find a way. I don't like using other people's towels as well. I feel sort of uncomfortable with washing with other people's towels.
You can bring your own towel. It's allowed.
I know, but that's kind of heavy in the but I will. Yes, I will take a towel.
I think you're staying in the wrong places.
Bad family.
All right, let's move along with some of the films to watch then. If we were to pop around to one of your houses, what would we be likely to see on the festive film agenda, Anna?
For this year specifically?
For the any year,
any
I suppose.
Year.
But if you've got any plans for this year?
Well, this year, I mean, of course, I've seen most things already in my job. If I'm going to rewatch, I would say Elf is always a popular family favourite.
Love Elf.
Yeah,
we love
so
Elf.
Much fun. And things like The Sound of Music and Wizard of Oz, even though they're not specifically Christmas films, just feel very Christmassy.
Absolutely.
And you can watch them as a family. And
absolutely.
They are, yes, they're not Christmas in them, but they are Christmas. Yeah.
I don't think they have Christmas in Oz. No. I'm not sure that's ever.
No, we're doing E.T. this year with a big fanfare. I mean, my children haven't seen E.T. and we've been waiting for a while to see E.T. I also struggle seeing E.T. because I just blub for about an hour since he gets a bit ill and then doesn't, and I just go, I'm gone. So I'm a bit worried about my children seeing me absolutely in pieces. But it is the E.T. 30th anniversary box set that we should be watching.
I can see our producer Holly Fisher nodding her head in glee. I just asked her before we came in what her favourite Christmas movie was, and E.T. was her pick.
Again, not a Christmas movie as
not
such.
At all.
Elf is, and we'll watch Elf as well.
But no, there are these films that do carry a festive flavour to them, mostly because they get repeated on television. Certainly the case in the case of The Wizard of Oz. Well, if you do want to see something new, then Anna and Jason are here to discuss what's on at the cinema right now and in the new year. So we're going to start with the big one. Can you guess what it is? Star Wars, The Last Jedi. Anna, this is the second film in the new Star Wars sequel trilogy. Give us a bit of a hint of what to expect.
Well, it's one of the longest in the series. It's 2.5 hours long, but I tell you what, it doesn't feel it. There's a lot of adventures running parallel. You have Rey, played by Daisy Ridley, going off to find Luke Skywalker. So that's their story. And then you've got Kylo Ren, played by Adam Driver, going through his own, dealing with his demons. And then, of course, you've got Finn going off on a journey with Rose, who's a great new character. So there's a lot of things going on, and of course, all the while we have General Leia back at the Resistance HQ, of course played by the late, great Carrie Fisher. So there are a lot of things coming together. It's a very busy film, but I thought it was very successful in keeping me on the edge of my seat and surprising me in points as well.
Jason, this is, of course, part of the new breed of Star Wars films that are being pumped out by Disney at the moment. And they've also got these other sort of films that take place in the universe that aren't necessarily a follow-on.
Like the Rogue
Ones. Exactly. Mm. How do you see this fitting in amongst all of that then?
I'm not a massive Star Wars fan, never really have been. I really enjoyed this one, though, which probably means that there are Star Wars fans out there who hate it. Because whenever I like something in a franchise that I don't particularly like, it means that it's a bit of an oddball one. And I know that there are some purists out there who have gone, oh, I saw new Star Wars is rubbish. And I go, that's because you're 50 years old. And you go, but I used to love them as a kid. Yes, because you were 10. It's not really the bright place for a 50-year-old. I thought it was fun. I laughed. I thought it was entertaining. I thought it was like they do with the Marvel series now. They overstuff it with every single character. For instance, like C-3PO and R2-D2 are in it for no real reason. They haven't really got much to do. And I thought, okay, you just don't need to have them in it. And then it goes on for 2.5 hours, as Anna says. And I said, just one planet too many. Don't need a little escapade over to that other funny planet. Even though I could watch John Boyega for ages, just give him his own one. Give him his own Rogue One. Give him his own Adam Driver. Brilliant, I think. And I think that's why this film is so successful. where you've got a villain whose face you can finally see, and therefore all the emotions in it, which you could, Darth Vader was always a problem. He's like, there's this asthmatic villain whose face I can't see. And now Adam Driver's great. He looks like a sort of teenager that's just like just been gaming in his room far too much and has come out like completely petulant and wants to destroy everything. So I think there's some brilliant elements in it. I think it's really funny, and it's got a sense of glee to it and playfulness and childishness, which I can't believe there are 50 grown adults my age coming up to me going, oh, what a load of rubbish. Like, it's Star Wars. It's supposed to be rubbish.
I guess part of the question then is that these films are becoming so much more commonplace all over our cinemas. If it's not a Marvel movie, it's a bloody Star Wars movie, isn't it? I guess the question is, I mean, look, I was recently on a long-haul flight. I watched a lot of Marvel movies, one after the other. Once I finished them, I thought, oh, that was a lot of fun. I don't feel very nourished. And that's not to do with the plane food. It was just because I think there's something about those films that are just fun to watch at the moment. But then you come away with not really very much going on inside your head. You don't really consider and think about what you just saw very much. Okay, I might be being a little bit too highbrow when we're talking about something like Star Wars or Marvel films. But Anna, is that really the approach that Disney is going with these sorts of films? To just give you a lot of quick hit entertainment, throw in a whole bunch of favourites in there because they know that's who we want to see, but don't challenge people too much?
I don't think so, actually. I agree with you about a lot of the Marvel Avengers films, but actually this I thought was quite nourishing spiritually. I mean, there's a whole push and pull between the dark side of the force and the positive. And personally, I was very excited about the amount of strong female characters in this film and the fact that you have women discussing military strategy. And that's something that helped me to get a lot more involved with it and finding it quite exciting and groundbreaking. It was moving on. It's also much more diverse. So I think they are taking it more seriously. And I actually, well, I largely agree with Jason. I actually did find all the planets and all the excitement, just all of it thrilling. I didn't feel it was too much. And I think actually they did an amazing job in developing the characters, considering how many there were pushing for space.
All right, we've got a little bit of a clip to hear of Star Wars. Let's have a listen.
Something inside me has always been there. But now it's awake. And I need help.
I've seen this raw strength only once before. It didn't scare me enough then. It does now.
Let the past die. Kill it. If you have to.
Star Wars, The Last Jedi there. Now, we do need to move on from this, but just before we do, of course, as you mentioned, this is the final film role for Carrie Fisher. How was it to see her in her swan song, Anna?
It was quite moving, actually. It was poignant, not just obviously knowing that she's since passed away, but in thematically, without giving too much away, in terms of what her character's journey. And she seemed very stately and controlled. There is that kind of curiosity factor where you're trying to work out at what point they filmed it. But at the same time, I think it was a fitting tribute and it is dedicated to her.
Jason, of course, you mentioned the Star Wars fans who were watching it when they were 10 years old. Now they're not 10 years old anymore. Will her farewell to the series, farewell to the screen, be fitting enough for the people who watched her and enjoyed her role so much in those original films?
Yeah, it's hard to know, as Anna says. There were bits, had they finished it entirely? She, of course, doesn't know. It's not like she kind of gives a knowing wink to the camera because I'll be off in a minute, don't worry about that. You know, so there's no sort of knowledge that you need to know that this is Carrie Fisher's last film. And I don't want to spoil the film to sort of say, well, do they incorporate that reality into the film itself? It's something we read onto it. We kind of foist that kind of, oh, look at that, that look to camera. She must have known she was about to die. She didn't, you know, I think, and nor did we. So I don't know what the pickups were or what the kind of extra CGI twinking was in there. And I'd like to leave that all as a surprise for those Star Wars fans. Yes, it is completely poignant. There's Luke Skywalker coming into this as well. All of those old mythologies are interesting because, like, is this for new fans or is this for old fans? And it's kind of they're trying to bridge them both. And as Anna says, that it does really well to move it on and develop Daisy Ridley, develop Finn, John Boyega, and develop Adam Driver as a kind of the new inheritors of this stuff, because Luke's getting a bit old for all this, is what I thought when I was watching that. And Carrie clearly is too now old for it, unfortunately. So there is that lightsaber needs to be handed on to the next generation.
Well, that is Star Wars The Last Jedi, out in cinemas absolutely everywhere right now. Moving along now to Molly's Game. Now, this is a biopic following the life, fittingly enough, of Molly Bloom, who is played by Jessica Chastain. Jason, who is Molly Bloom?
Who is Molly Bloom? Well, she's the heroine of Finnegan's Wake, isn't she, as well? I don't think that there's any Joycean reference in there in particular in this one, but she's called Molly Bloom. She was a real-life person who started out as a moguls champion. That's ski bumps for you. And then ended up, because of an injury, running high-stakes poker tables and poker games in Los Angeles and New York, where kind of high rollers would come in, some famous people, and gamble lots of money. And they were at Molly's table, and she kind of ran the games, really. And that's the story here. And then she gets arrested by the FBI for kind of, I don't quite know for what, laundering money, or kind of, because you're not really supposed to run high-stakes poker games, I think, independently. So she gets arrested for all that. And she says, well, I didn't do anything wrong. I just kind of opened my doors and all these famous people came in and played poker. And then she writes a book about it. So in the film, she hires a lawyer, played by Idris Elba, to kind of defend her. And he's a bit sort of sceptical about defending her and whether he should and shouldn't. But eventually her fast-talking ways, because she's scripted by Aaron Sorkin, convince him that he should take her on. And then she tells him exactly what she's done in minute detail over the last sort of few years, and we get those games reconstructed, and it's done at 4,000 miles an hour. I don't play poker, I don't really understand it at all, and so every sort of turn of the card was like, oh, and it always is with me in poker games. I don't even know if that's exciting or not. Does two pairs beat an eight? I don't know. So it lost me, and it's all people talking very quickly and coming in and out of rooms and doing the same thing again over and over again.
Well, I guess poker, not exactly the most cinematic of all
games. And yet it's in 100 million films.
I guess it's very sophisticated, isn't it? But you don't necessarily need to see
my
the other side of
my brother plays poker. It's not sophisticated, surely.
I don't know. I don't think you might be up against James Bond when it comes to that.
Oh, yes, he's better than my brother.
Anna, let's talk about Aaron Sorkin. Everyone seems to have a bit of a love-hate relationship with him. Everyone loves him for The West Wing. They hated him for The Newsroom. Everyone loved him again for The Social Network. What's he up to here? He's directing the film.
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought he did largely a very good job. I think possibly the biggest problem here is he indulged himself in the running time and it's too long. It could definitely be about 20 minutes shorter. And I think it got to that point where you think, I'm loving this film. It's absolutely amazing. Oh gosh, it's just lost a star because it's just going on and it doesn't know where to end. And that was a real shame. But as Jason said, it's very much obviously scripted by him. It's got his style. And I really like that. And I think Jessica Chastain is a really good match for that really kind of smart, witty, fast talking. And for goodness, you know, back on the feminist thing again, but to see a woman taking on the guys in this kind of film, you don't see that very often on the screen. And she does it absolutely brilliantly. So there was an element of it being quite satisfying, the way she was sort of triumphing. One of my biggest problems actually was Idris Elba in this. I just didn't think he would brought much passion to it. I thought he was phoning it in a bit. It's strange. Like, there's something about him that does a good physical performances these days, but his dialogue delivery just didn't seem very convincing. Maybe it doesn't fit well with Sorkin. I don't know.
How do you feel about the way that Aaron Sorkin portrays women on the screen then? Because there have been a few questions posed about that as well. Some of the portrayals of the strong female leads in The Newsroom in particular, there are a few questions raised about whether they were fully three-dimensional characters compared to some of the men in there. But you say in this particular film, he's done very well.
I think he has. And I think working with a real-life subject who's been able to work with closely must have helped. And obviously Jessica Chastain, who feels very strongly about women in film and representations of women on film. She's not exactly someone that you'd necessarily look up to in every sense, but she's obviously a very, very sharp cookie who made some smart decisions and some not so smart decisions. But it's great fun seeing her do them. And regardless, I mean, I don't have any interest in poker either, but I think there's something quite alluring about those glamorous settings and people just throwing all their money away, even though it has me on the edge of my seat because I hate seeing people gamble millions of dollars. It's terrifying to me.
I lost £300 or $300 once in Las Vegas in 10 minutes, and I've never gamble set. I was like, this is not for me. I'm stopping right here. When the fun stops, stop.
Well said.
Yeah, brilliant advice from Jason Solomons. That is Molly's Game. Before we go, let's hear a bit of a clip of that.
You spent 8 years in Hollywood and 2 years in New York running the world's most exclusive and decadent man cave.
Have you seen the other names in your indictment? Come on, Marty, just how deep into the Russian mob were you?
Your exposure's crazy.
You got 2.8 million on the street right now.
You're gonna get blown up.
You managed to build a multi-million dollar business using not much more than your wits.
I'm about to be charged in federal court.
Well, nobody's perfect.
That's Molly's Game, out in cinemas on New Year's Day. Now moving along to a Western called Hostiles, starring Christian Bale and Rosamund Pike. Anna, tell us about this one. It takes us on a bit of an adventure. Are we talking about the old classic style Western? Because I think Western conjures up images in people's heads, but a modern Western, no one really knows what to expect, do they?
It's one of those more modern ones in that it tries to look at the conflict between Native Americans and the soldiers who are trying to protect their own and the conflict there. It's kind of a character-driven journey film. You know, it would be a road trip, but there are no roads. But it's Christian Bale plays an army captain who's pretty racist, but has some kind of principles somewhere back in his mind. And he's sort of grudgingly escorting a Cheyenne war chief, played by Wes Studi, across the plains. They quite quickly encounter a grieving widow played by Rosamund Pike, who has lost her family and has had unimaginable distress. And one of the things I found most interesting about it was her performance and how she's dealing with this trauma of losing her family. She does that absolutely brilliantly. As you can tell, it's pretty serious stuff, and obviously there's going to be some people growing closer across the course of this journey, and there's a good deal of violence. So it's not a Western as in there's saloons and swinging doors. It's a Western out in the plains where people are trying to survive and turning on each other.
A lot of people have said that this is a very slow-moving film. That seems to be something we say about Westerns, especially modern Westerns, quite a lot. Does it fit, do you think? Does the feeling of a slow-moving, slow-burning plot, does it feel like this is the kind of film that should have something like that, or is it just plain slow?
I think it's slow in a fairly good way. I mean, I wouldn't say this is something that's a must-see, but if that kind of film appeals to you, you will probably like it. I mean, I enjoyed it. I found the characters interesting. I'd have actually could have spent more time in them. I think the Native American characters could have been more developed. That's one of the problems with it. But generally, I think it uses its running time quite well, and it's fairly satisfying watch.
It looks a bit of a fashion shoot to me. It looks like Ros Pike. I haven't only seen the trailer and the poster, and Ros Pike looking very well lit and kind of quite got her look kind of worked out for a grieving widow. I think that's a kind of, she's got a nice little Hannah hat thing. She can come straight off Condé Nast Traveller's shoot of Westerns when they're to stay in a nice spa, in an Adobe spa somewhere.
The nice hat bit, no spoilers, the nice hat bit is not when she's on the road. So, don't worry. On the road, she's actually got this sort of bloodstained nightdress sort of thing.
I have a real problem seeing her, because I know Ros Pike, and I have a real problem seeing her like in the Western. I mean, the Western Avenue, maybe. You know, I can't see her like in the Western, you know, just saying.
That there is no escaping how beautiful she is, and she has had that sort of porcelain skin and luminous beauty, which, yeah, it's very cinematic.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she's still really, really good. You can tell that
good.
From me.
Jason, where are we at with the Western then more generally? Because we have seen a few Westerns in recent years. And as I mentioned to Anna, we don't really ever know what to expect when
a Western they're very much a genre now. I think that they're not supposed to be real. They're supposed to be there for some metaphorical reason, like when Kelly Reichardt did Meek's Cut Off. That was very slow. It was trying to be original and trying to get really under the mud of Westerns now. We're trying to do them about hard scrabble. Then there was that awful one that was Brimstone that was out this year with Guy Pearce and Dakota Fanning, one of the worst films I've ever seen in my entire life. It's just horrible. I think people are trying to play with them now as well, because they're so rare now, Westerns, that it becomes like, let's do one Western a year, so a studio will come out with it, and let's kind of dig into American mythology and maybe kind of make it reflect how where we're coming from and where we're going to in the future. So it's about that players, like, and I said they never really developed the Native American characters. They had the Lone Ranger with Johnny Depp not that long ago, which kind of tried to. No one really knows what to do with them anymore. I've got a suggestion. Let's not make any more of them.
How harsh. It does seem that genre filmmaking is very much in, though, because if you look at serious dramas, you can't really be a serious drama unless you're baiting the Oscars, can you? It's not enough to simply be a drama that is quite good anymore. Either you've got to be the big budget special effects, or you are The Post, which is clearly aiming to be the best picture of next year.
That's okay for studios to have that effect. I mean, what I would like is that for it to coalesce and be a big budget blockbuster that's also got the credentials enough and skill enough to become a sort of Oscar winner, you know. That would be amazing.
Spoken like really, a true film critic, Jason.
I would love to see that. It'd be awesome.
Just before we move along, let's hear a clip of Hostiles.
Captain, you do know Chief Yellowhawk. The Army wants to be certain that the Chief gets home to Montana safely without incident.
I have any idea. He's a butcher.
And the two of you ought to get along just fine.
I've killed savages, because that's my job.
You have no idea what war does to a man. I hate him. I got a war bag of reasons to hate him.
This will be done, and it will be done by you.
Parade's over. Put him in chains.
Well, it's all very serious, isn't it? There was Hostiles. It's out on limited release in the US today, and it will hit the UK on January 5th, so keep an eye out for that. Now, finally, we are jumping back into the fantastical land of Jumanji. Yes, you heard right. Over 20 years since the hit Robin Williams film took us all on a tropical trip into a board game, we meet four teenagers who get sucked into the world through an old game console. Of course they do. Let's hear a clip of this one.
Oh my God. Fridge?
Yeah, I'm Fridge. Who are you?
It's me, Spencer.
Who is she?
Martha?
Why am I wearing half a shirt and short shorts in the jungle?
I think we got sucked into Jumanji and we become the avatars we chose.
So that means...
Bethany?
Oh, wait, Bethany, don't look at it!
I'm an overweight, middle-aged man.
Well, I don't have my Claritin, and all I see around here is pollen.
Well, I don't have the top 2 feet of my body.
Damn, that is a man right there. Don't cry, don't cry. Don't cry, it's gonna be okay.
Okay, so that is Jumanji, the new version. I can only remember the Robin Williams version. Everyone that I went to school with loved that, Anna. This one, I don't know how I feel about this. Tell me how I feel about this, Anna.
I think you should feel actually positive about it. I surprised myself how much I enjoyed this. It's sort of a body swap comedy in many ways. So it has that retro feel. There's someone that grew up in this kind of 80s film like Big. Because these, as you gathered from the trailer, these young school teenagers go into the video game and they become the avatars that they've chosen. So the dweeby guy becomes Dwayne Johnson. The girl who's constantly Instagramming and who's really vain is Jack Black. So there's some kind of interesting gender play there, as well as stereotype play, and it does do something quite serious in a very fun way, looking into appearances and how we judge people and how we come across, because you're constantly thinking, oh, Jack Black is actually this 16-year-old girl. And he's obviously very, very funny with that, especially when he needs to go to the toilet. And it's the moment you're waiting for, and you're just, and I love that they actually go there. So, it's funny.
So it's clearly a lot of fun and aiming towards people at the festive, during the festive period. Is the timing right? Are we far enough away from the original to appeal to people? And are people going to be feeling able that they can just, you know, let go of the original and have a bit of fun with this one?
I'll be absolutely honest with you. I still haven't seen the original. So maybe I'm coming into it fresh. It was just that time, like, I was too old, but I wasn't yet a film critic, so why would I go and see it?
I'm with you. Exactly. Yeah. Never seen.
But now I'm going to go back and watch it for the first time. But having watched the trailer and stuff, I mean, there's quite a big difference, because that one is, as I understand it, them coming into the characters from the game coming into the real world, whereas this is our characters going into the world in the game, which I think is more involving potentially. And it's just really sharply written. It's funny. And I think parents might be surprised if they go with their kids, or even if they decide to have a few beers and go on their own. It is actually really a good giggle.
I think what's really interesting is what Anna says there, is that back in the day it was like, oh, the computer games are going to take over your life. You know, and they would come to real life and kind of come into your room. And it was the computer game coming out into reality. And now we've moved on so many years, was it 25 years, that we're so used to disappearing into computer games, that that's what many young people do anyway, that actually us going into the unreality is the more natural journey as well. There's no fear. That's where the scariness is, that we're not going to be able to get out of the unreality rather than it's going to infect our reality. So that, I think that's an interesting thing. I did see some interesting, you mentioned about gender play, and I saw some interesting kind of respondents to the poster sort of saying, well, you know, the blokes are wearing, you know, gear, and then the girl is obviously in a jungle where there's, you know, creepy crawlies and she's kind of got a midriff open and she's wearing shorts, and that was a kind of bad play. And that's Karen Gillan, who used to be Doctor Who.
But when you watch it, I think her riposte to that has been correct, because the point is it's a Lara Croft Tomb Raider kind of 90s cliche, the character. But then there's this young geeky girl that comes into that body and she really doesn't know what to do with it. It's like going through adolescence all at once. And they kind of play with that, and they also kind of put it down. I mean, it's having its cake and eating it, because obviously they can still have a sexy girl on the poster and then go, oh, well, it's terribly bad. but they do deal with that in quite a clever way when you actually watch it. Yeah.
So clearly this is an enjoyable film. Anna, you're saying it's actually got enough brains behind it to get away with it being an enjoyable film aimed at the holidays.
Yeah, it's very, very lighthearted, but it's well done. Yeah, I would absolutely recommend it if you're after a laugh.
Fantastic. That is Jumanji. Welcome to the Jungle, out in cinemas now. Jason and Anna, thank you very much for your reviews today. Now, do stick around because we have our global countdown in just a moment. But first, we're hopping over to Edmonton International Airport in Canada, where a new storytelling initiative has been set up. It's called the Short Story Dispenser and is a thin tower that functions similarly to an ATM, except that you get a story told by local writers rather than a wad of cash. We sent Monocle's contributor, Sheena Rossiter, to the airport to try it out.
With the click of a button, out comes a short story, printed on what looks like long and narrow receipt paper. The novelty of a short story dispenser that gives any passerby here at the Edmonton International Airport a story for free got here thanks to the hard work and persistence of local Edmontonian writer Jason Norman.
A couple years ago, I saw a video of this machine in France. They had just been kind of unveiled, and they were around like train stations and other kind of buildings in France. But as soon as I saw it, I just immediately saw the possibilities for what something like that could do and like how people engage with short stories and like literature and in public. So I just immediately started to write to the company.
After going back and forth for over a year with the creators of the short story dispenser machine, a startup called Short Edition that's based out of France, Jason knew the right place for the machine would be in the airport. And the team at the Edmonton International Airport were quickly on board.
When I showed them the video, they kind of got it. They understood it. They saw how it was kind of cool and novel, but also they saw the possibilities. It went pretty easy from there. I knew that things would take time, but after the first meeting, it got easier. So if I met them in January, it was about June when I got the email that said they were going to buy one. So if I could start to collect stories and start to communicate with writers, I should get on that right away. So credit to the people at the airport. They saw the value in what this could bring to the passenger experience.
All in your Hamilton.
Only until just before the short story dispenser was revealed in the airport, the project was shrouded in mystery, even for the local authors. Jason Norman explains why.
I was trying to keep it a secret because I didn't want to let the cat out of the bag too early, and also it was kind of the airport's surprise, I guess, to they wanted to tell people when they wanted to tell people.
But for local authors like Michael Hingston, it made the writing process more challenging, to say the least.
So I got an email in July that was just subject line said secret project, which again is not unusual from Jason. The criteria were that he wanted short fiction that was between 100 and 1,500 words long, had to be unpublished. All he would say is that it was aimed at a broad audience. Anyone could potentially read this. And he said, it doesn't have to be about Edmonton, but if it's named after a city or country in the world, that would be a bonus, but is not required. So what do you do with that? I mean, it's good to know that stuff, but I just feel like that's so mysterious and so appealing. I had no idea what that meant.
So far at the airport, after just a few weeks of use, the short story dispenser is being put to good use, as Tracy Bednard, a spokesperson for Edmonton International Airport, explains.
We started off with 78 authors, and since we launched at the beginning of December, we've had 30 new authors that have submitted stories. So it's just a great opportunity to reflect our local community here in the airport. This is a really unique opportunity for a lot of those authors. So they've been able to talk about it a lot as well and what it means for them to be here in the international airport. It's part of our whole program to try to reflect Edmonton to ourselves as a community, but also to all the visitors that come to our region.
We're here at the short story dispenser, and Tracy is just going to select a story. What story are you going to select? A 1, a 3, or a 5 minute?
Yeah, well, this is the big decision, right? So this is where, as a traveler, you know, you tend to be kind of rushed, so you have to make a decision on that. So I'm going to, you know, go straight in the middle and go for the 3 minute. So I just press the button, and it's choosing for me.
Which one did you get here?
All right, so this is called A Lovely Person by Plotine. And it starts with, as usual, the 0645 train was late. Aurora climbed up the high steps to the carriage and went to sit in the folding seat at the end, the one which faced away from all the other passengers. That kind of seems, you know, kind of seems well-suited. It's a travel story.
This comes from the short edition from the originally translated from French, correct?
That's correct. And then at the end, there's a little logo there to make sure people, if they take it with them, remember that they had that at Edmonton International Airport. And we also have a website at flyeia.com/short edition. And so people can take a look and go, you know, take a little more time and find all the local authors that are featured in the library.
With about half of the short stories in the dispenser being from local authors, here's a taste of some Edmontonian literature. This is a 3-minute story read by local author Michael Hingston himself.
The Capital by Michael Hingston. He had a diploma. He had ideas. He had time on his hands. He started a blog. He had the knack. He followed the conversations. He enjoyed the process. He wrote strong entries with weak headlines. It was an incomplete kind of knack. He changed the logo. He threw things at the wall. He noted what stuck. He cross-promoted. He knew a guy who knew computers. He told his parents. He wanted commenters. He deleted their comments. He had an audience. He suspected bots. He had merch. He shelled out for the online store option. He had a closet full of hats with the old logo. He liked a girl. He swung. He missed. He moved to the capital. He was open to possibility. He went for walks. He breathed different air. He liked the word wayfinding. He found a new favorite restaurant. He sat alone, ordered the special. He started believing in cliches. He had more ideas, bigger ones. He had a fun twist on casual Fridays. He had a plan. He forgot to buy new clothes. He gained a bit of weight. He had hobbies. He posted on hobby-specific message boards. He was an early adopter. He lost entire evenings to nothing in particular, an ambient buzzing in his ears. He liked a girl. He rebranded. He updated Flash. He deleted more comments. He didn't notice what wasn't there. He moved to a new neighborhood. He built a shelf. He flossed. He believed whatever aspect of his life he was focused on was improving. He ordered dinner ingredients through an online subscription. He wrote the coupon code down on a piece of scrap paper. He simplified his life. He outsourced the things he wasn't good at. He monetized the things he was. He asked hard questions about which of his possessions sparked joy and found he did not know how to answer. He squeezed people out. He called in old debts. He read Wikipedia entries all the way to the end. He found the closet of old hats and briefly didn't recognize them. He let his life be taken over by diversions. He floated with the current. He didn't like the word wayfinding. He mistook discomfort for pain. He stopped flossing. And when, finally, he went looking for anger, he found it everywhere.
The short story dispenser will be a permanent fixture at the Edmonton International Airport. So it's likely to keep growing its library of local authors and will continue to share it with whoever passes through. For Monocle in Edmonton, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thank you, Sheena. Now, as always, we'll round off the show with this week's Global Countdown with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, thank you for popping in.
No worries. Always a pleasure.
We've still got Jason and Anna here with me as well. Fernando, tell us, where are we off to?
We're going closer to home today, to the UK. And the only reason, because, you know, it's Christmas week, and I think the UK is one of the countries that most enjoy its Christmas songs, I have to say. And it's been reflected quite a lot in the chart this week.
Because Christmas number one's a big thing in the UK. I don't know if it is anywhere else in the world.
No, not really.
Was
actually,
it in Brazil when you were growing up?
People kind of don't care. We don't have so many traditional songs. To be honest, it's most covers of John Lennon, basically. But here in the UK, it's quite a big tradition. Shall we count down very quickly, top five?
Absolutely. Let's start at number five.
We have a short clip of Rita Ora with Anywhere, number five. An excellent electropop track, I must say. Shall we listen to it? Just
So, Fernando, that is Rita Ora, number five there. Sort of a non-distinct sort of track.
Yeah, non-distinct, but it works.
I love it.
Do you know what I mean?
It's got two fans in the studio, Anna.
Yeah.
It's got a decent beat, but I think I could get bored of it quite quickly.
Yeah, but I saw you guys dancing.
I love it. I love a big chorus. I like it when any song that goes bibbidi-deep, bibbidi-deep, but it can't work out what I sing.
But if there's something that can beat number five, it's number four, actually. It's Camila Cabello with... sorry, that sounds very... It's true. It's Havana, you know, and she's showing her Latin vibes, and we have a clip of that as well.
Let's have a listen. I actually woke up with that song in my head this morning, Fernando.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I must have had a premonition.
You sure it wasn't hangover?
It might have been, actually. It is that time of year.
Yes, and sorry to do the cliche, but I have to say, for example, number three is better than four and five. I mean, and it's a classic, and I have some trivia here for you guys. It's the biggest selling number two of all time, because, as you can see, it's a song it's been around, I have to say. Any guesses?
It was the biggest selling number two, and now it's number three.
Now it's number three. It's back in the charts.
Okay.
So it's an old song.
Is it Band-Aid?
Almost.
But that was number one. Is it the second Band-Aid that wasn't the first Band-Aid?
You're almost there, because actually Band-Aid was number one when this song was number two. It's, of course, by Wham, Last Christmas.
And it's not number two. Oh, it's nearly a year since George.
And actually, guys, because Ben was asking about the Christmas number one and everything, there is a campaign here in the UK for next week for this song to be number one, in tribute, of course, of George Michael, which is incredibly sad. Yeah. Who knows, it might be number one. But for now, it's number three and is a Christmas classic.
Absolutely, Fernando.
I think we should hear it, right?
Let's have a quick listen. Fernando, it's so hard to release a popular Christmas song, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people do it, but very, very few ever release a Christmas song that's actually memorable, that's played the Christmas after and the Christmas after that and so on.
And it's such a cozy season. I think it is quite hard, because we have already so many like strong classics. I don't actually people want, you know, something too different or too new in a way. So I think we're going to have Wham for quite a few years in the chart. And the number two as well, I must say.
Yeah.
Which is becoming a little bit of a modern classic.
I think it's well and truly become a modern classic.
Yeah.
Right now. I mean, every
time... She was performing in the UK, actually, recently.
Every time we get to Christmas, this song is played so often that the artist can afford to buy herself another house.
Yeah. And let's be honest, she didn't release any nice new tracks recently.
Huh? I mean,
not being bitchy at all.
Isn't this the first year that she... She normally does it in America and tours America, getting a house for selling it. And now she's come to the UK for the first time ever and done
it here. 5-star reviews everywhere, you know, say, you know, it's all you want for Christmas.
Yeah, I think, Mariah Carey, of course, definitely one of the absolute classic Christmas artists. All I Want for Christmas Is You. Let's hear a clip. Make my wish come true. Unbeatable, isn't it?
It is unbeatable.
Completely unbeatable.
It makes me emotional, actually, in some ways. I don't
does
know.
It not from Love Actually, I hope.
No,
that's all right.
Not
then.
From Love Actually.
I know Anna Smith does a good version of that.
Not right now with this
story,
but normally,
you'd be better with that.
Amazing. Yeah.
Next time, I'll be.
Luckily, I'm off the hook today.
I just feel sorry, guys, that the number one song is actually by Ed Sheeran again.
Yeah, I mean, even Christmas can't budge
even
Ed
Christmas,
Sheeran.
You know, who knows? Maybe it's going to be Wham or Ed Sheeran. Perhaps it's going to be Ed Sheeran again. But, you know, the song is called Perfect, and he's quite smart again. There's a new interest in the song, because I think there's two versions going around, three versions, the original one, the one of Beyoncé, and there's a special one of Andrea Bocelli as well, like an orchestral special version. So I think all the sales of all those different Perfect, which is the name of the singles, count for the number one. And it's Ed Sheeran. We've been playing here the whole year, and we have to play it again.
Oh, we have to. All right. Baby, I'm dancing in the dark with you between my arms, barefoot on the grass, listening to our favorite song. When you said you looked a mess. Oh, it's a nice track, isn't it? I mean, I get a little bit kind of tired of seeing him in the Countdown all the time, but every time I hear his music, it's like, oh, it sounds a bit nice, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's not like Shape of You, but it's okay, you know? And, and you know, I've been reading interviews with him. He seems like a nice guy. You know, there's a lot of haters around, but, you know, just stop hating and listen to Mariah Carey instead, you know? So make her number one, who knows?
Fernando's advice to life. Thank you very much, Fernando. That was great. That brings us to the end of today's program. Thanks very much to my guests, Anna Smith and Jason Solomons, too. This show was produced by Holly Fisher, and of course, Fernando was our researcher. I'm Ben Ryland. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, let's play it out with some more of that number one song in the UK. Here's Ed Sheeran. Thanks for listening. I found a love for me. Well, darling, just dive right in and follow my lead. Well, I found a girl, beautiful and sweet. Well, I never knew.